Before I get into the guts of my talk, I do mention some data that particularly was brought up in Paul Fields' paper on temperature extremes and insect control and stored product insects. And I realize a lot of you have done work in cold temperature or freezing at some point in time or another. And so I just wanted to make that sort of overall statement, because what I have taken from and I'm going to show you is of direct lineage from all of the experience so far gathered. I find freezing very interesting. When I went to the University of Minnesota, of course, Mario Carrillo was just finishing up, and he did a postdoc with me working on working with freezing of stored grain and control of the Indian meal moth. And with the equipment and with the methods that he had developed, I took those over when he was doing his postdoc, and got very interested in it from a point of view of having an additional non-chemical tool that can be used in particular circumstances to control for stored product pests. The one thing I did find, though, and you know, I can easily ask you a couple of questions in a second, but one thing I did really find was that although there's all sorts of data out there for controlling and for insects surviving at low temperature, particularly stored grain insects, there's a real gap in terms of the practicality of this method. The advantages, of course, naturally occurring, you know, if we look at it on a worldwide basis, the top part of the world and the bottom part of the world go through some sort of a freeze cycle that could be used to advantage. So you add a little bit of electricity at key points in time, drive the fans in grain storage, and you can chill, you can freeze grain, particularly the top parts of the grain. It does have disinfestation, it does have suppression of activity as well, and Flavio will talk about grain chilling. I'm talking about the actual disinfestation that would be equivalent to using a fumigant. It's a non-chemical control, so it has very favorable aspects when we talk about replacing methyl bromide and other products, the organic market. And we also have a new market that's potentially coming up, the green program type of market, where they are looking at using no chemicals whatsoever in their in control of insects. This is going to be largely a physical or environmental types of control. And so we are moving there, although the organic market is still building, we are moving to a period where there may be a wider spread use of non-chemical controls. And then it does have the advantages that at-risk product can be held at low temperatures or can be repeatedly treated as conditions are required. Now, the disadvantages, as I mentioned, are the major gaps in knowledge. Taking it from the fact that, yes, we can freeze insects, to if we have a super tote sitting in a warehouse or in a food processing plant, how are we going to deliver that treatment effectively and equivalent to a fumigation? And if you think to yourself, those of you who are extension entomologists out in the audience, how many times have you thrown out the number of, well, you'll need to freeze for 10 days to 2 weeks if someone calls you up and says, well, I have a freezer, I have product that could be frozen, how long do I need to hold it for? And usually the answer is, well, 10 days to 2 weeks. And quite often, you know, you only need a couple of days, but you want to make darn sure that you're not dealing with like temperatures in the freezer that are not quite right, or does the equipment have a defrost cycle, or the amount of material that they're doing, or the type of insect that you're working with. And so all of these represent gaps in knowledge, and I think what we need to work for freezing of insects disinfestation is the point where we have information equivalent to what we do with fumigations. You saw a lot of information presented, and when someone calls me up about doing an SF fumigation, I know I have the numbers, or I can get the numbers very adequately to give those answers, to tell them what sort of time, what sort of CT is required. However, with freezing, we just do not have that. Product stability, both during and post, what sort of equipment do we need? You know, if we're in Minnesota, now Paul, you mentioned minus 30, we were a little bit more tropical, we were at minus 25 Celsius the other day, and you know, what sort of equipment do we need in that area? Or if I have a grocery store that has an ice cream freezer at minus 21 Celsius, is that useful? And so, and then we also get food processing plants that now have, are now sourcing product from worldwide and are looking for an automatic non-fumigant treatment method, and so they've gone to freezers. But what size of freezer do they need to use? Not just cooling. So in reality, you know, with these gaps in knowledge, and then you add the fact that we've got an age of very tight margins in the, throughout the food processing and into the retail, energy costs, facility specialization, you know, these facilities are not general use facilities, they're usually specific to doing something. If it's retail, it's getting the food in, getting the food sold, getting the food to the consumer. If it's processing, it's getting the ingredients in, getting the product out. And then we also have just in time. So this idea of, well, if what do you mean I got to take my these containers of super totes out of process for 2 or 3 weeks so that we can do an adequate freeze. So basically, there's no room for error, and it really needs a these gaps in knowledge need to be filled. So considering the disadvantages, some of the work that I've been doing at Minnesota have been to look at sort of the three areas, the pest itself, the product at risk, and in some cases the method of freezing. And what I would like to do is just summarize four studies that that I've been involved with, and to some degrees, of course, Mario Carrillo had started this, and I'll certainly pass his name off as the person who helped me get going in the raw grain area. But then I also want to talk about a study that we did with ingredients, and then a study that we did in the finished product area in terms of disinfesting at-risk product. So the first study is, again, Mario's culmination of work, overwintering mortality of Indian meal moth in southern Minnesota. I'm not going to go through all of the details because I recognize I don't have a lot of time here. But essentially, what he found was that the Indian meal moth seems to be the most cold, hardy insect that we deal with in stored grain. If we deal with holding seasonal adjusted Indian meal moth larvae, fifth instar, at minus 10, we're looking at about 300 hours before we start to get to the 100% mortality range. Now, I'll have a comment on that in a second, but when we talk about Indian meal moth in the, and actually, just to step back, this is a very interesting number because, you know, when we start thinking global warming and everything like that, we didn't hit that type of number until the middle of March in Minnesota last year. And so, you know, we did have a problem where, potential problem where we had at-risk grain at that point, even in Minnesota. We do take temperatures in grain bins, and you can see that although the exterior and the headspace air can drop down quite low, minus 10, minus 14 on average, and you know, when we're looking at grain mass itself, the grain mass maybe gets down to about minus 4, and that's you know, point, that's just a tenth of a meter underneath, and at 0.4 meters underneath, we're still well within a range where the Indian meal moth could survive if they're only being subjected to this temperature. Of course, a drawdown type of event where you're using the fans at right temperatures to pull the cold air down, you can certainly drop the temperature of that grain down to appreciable levels where we can start getting control. Now, one of the things that Mario had asked is, could we model cold hardiness and account for temperature, time, and microhabitat? Certainly, the supercooling point of seasonal adjusted Indian meal moth larvae is down near about minus 28 Celsius, and that supercooling point is the point where all tissues in and all water in the body crystallizes or freezes. And we're probably not going to get to that, so we're going to deal with sort of a time issue. And so Mario set up, of course, number of cages in grain at different levels. They used the aeration from the that was normally supplied to the bin, and then they used thermocouples. And here you're looking at the temperatures. Here you're looking at with the triangles of when they did aeration. Here's mortality here. The date is along the bottom, and then the ambient temperature is up the side here, ambient and bin temperature. This is at 5 centimeters of depth in the center. This is on the east side, 5 centimeters of depth. And you can certainly see that we can achieve 100% mortality by using some sort of aeration event when the temperatures are right. And typically the temperatures are hitting, the air temperatures are hitting down near minus 10, minus 20, that sort of thing. Now with the model that he did, he looked at cumulative cooling degree hours. And this is essentially the percentage mortality over the degree days that you use for insect development. We just turn it upside down and we look at cooling days. It's also a common practice for those that are trying to speculate on oil and sell oil as well. How much oil do we have to have in supply? And you can see as the cumulative degree hours of coldness progress, of course, we get a nice mortality curve. When we look at thresholds of 2 degrees Celsius for cooling or 5 degrees, we do get different curves. The interesting thing, this is the hollow circles are the 1 year, the second year are the solid circles, and you can see that we were getting some mortality outside of this model, and it seemed to be that there was a little bit more cooling, aggressive cooling going on. And so the model, it does actually hit when both years, and these years seem to be an extreme in terms of temperature, but when both years we're still getting the model estimating close to when the 100% is going to occur. Now the problem is though that we wanted to know, well, how do we account for trying to deal with this, because there's a fairly heavy amount of time in cooling degree hours between this area here and this area here. And so what we did was we looked at the data again and used a different model, cumulative lethality index. It works on a couple of other principles, chemical principles. But it's just a different way of looking at it. And but instead of looking at the progression of mortality, we just want to get a point when we know that it's likely that the CLI will be 1. That means there's 100% mortality occurring. And what we find with this model is here's the cumulative cooling degree hours. You can see that in that 1 year we weren't able to estimate these two. We were actually late in the season. Here with the CLI, it built up very quickly, and we were actually very close to, in both cases, if not slightly before, the point at which the measured mortality was found. Now, it's probably going to be something of a combination of this model with this model, just so that we don't end up estimating ahead of time the 100% mortality occurring. But with these models, hopefully we'll be able to set up some sort of a calculator that the producer can use to say, yes, if we run the aeration fence at this point, we drop the temperature down to this point for this length of time, we'll get 100% mortality of the insects in the grain. So natural freezing conditions are certainly useful in stored grain. Again, a combination of CLI and the cumulative cooling degree hours. Bringing these details to the producer is important. We're still seeing a lot of farms that are not monitoring temperature, so how are we going to deal with that on the farm? We're not too sure. And then, of course, this is Minnesota. This will probably work in Winnipeg, but will it work for, say, Kansas or somewhere else where we might have those cold temperatures, but they're going to occur with a lot less frequency? Okay, that was the raw grain. Let's talk a little bit about different ingredients. And the study that Abby Walter and I just finished had to do with food types and their influences on development and physiological parameters in the Indian meal moth, particularly with supercooling point. We know that development is impacted by the diet in insects, okay? And that's sort of a no-brainer. But the challenge is, if you want to do sort of physiological measures of insects on different diets, you have to stagger when the diets are put onto the, or the insects are put onto the diet so that you get the same physiological age at the time you do the study. So this was, although you know you've seen a lot of development papers in the past, this was very challenging because we had to do a full development study before we even turned around and did the physiology. We did a number of different ingredients, basically fed larvae from hatch through to fifth instar on a number of different ingredients. The diet, or the standard lab diet, was the control. We had commodity-like foods, just simple foods and simple grains, and then we had more complex foods that we used in this. Of course, again, the diets are ordered based on no pupation, and then the point of time when development was greatest to when the diet was the best and the development time was the shortest. So you'll see that order occur in the next few slides. And so, yes, development time is definitely impacted by diet. Survivorship sort of is an inverse. The survivorship is best on the lab diet, whereas if we're dealing with, say, birdseed, soy, peanuts, whole corn type of thing, we're down a little bit lower. There's a effect to survivorship there. Now the interesting thing is, again, we're ordering from best to worst, from worst to best diet here from a point of view of development numbers. Now the interesting thing is when you look at the supercooling point, all bets are off. 3 minutes? Okay, thank you. In fact, the diet by itself, and now these are insects that have not gone through a seasonal adjustment or any sort of habitat effects. This is unseasoned insects. You'll notice that the worst diet to be on for insect survival in terms of the supercooling point is actually the lab diet. And if you feed them on peanuts or soy or whole corn, you can actually get a supercooling point that approaches the supercooling point of an insect on that has gone through a seasonal adjustment. And so this was very quite surprising to us in terms of what it would mean out in the field. It means that, you know, basically we have to look at the insect, look at what it's feeding on to determine how we're going to kill it by cold temperatures. Now we are extending this study now to include looking at the lower lethal times and the lower lethal temperatures, but this was quite astounding, the fact that we could just simply change their diet and get this huge swing of supercooling points. And this is, and just by the way, Mario had initially done the work with the diets, but he had provided identifiable products that were considered to be cryoprotectants into the diet, and he found that there was no effect in the supercooling point. And yet, with different diets and we had not accounted for cryoprotectants at this point, we did get substantial differences. The final part that I want to talk about is some freeze disinfestation of mold mites that we were dealing with. There's the mite, the small animal. There's it in large numbers on the retail shelf and surfaces. This is actually a curtain of mites hanging off this shelf. You can see all this. These are all live mites crawling around on this retail shelf. This is happening with some different brands of pet food. And basically, the way that a retail store has to deal with this is to literally strip the entire shelving area down and clean it up. But the question is, okay, yeah, we had infested product we can identify. What about the uninfested material, but it's at risk? Well, could we freeze it? Thank you. Yes. So we. But then the question is, well, how do we freeze it in such large quantity? Certainly, they're not going to stack bags individually. They're going to put it onto skids. We also wanted to know what was the capabilities of this insect to survive. The supercooling point is minus 24, and it ranges minus 21 to minus 26. The lower lethal temperature was very interesting in that we were getting at the supercooling point, we were getting mites surviving. And so that was interesting. We still had quite a bit of death occurring, but if we wanted to look at 100%, we were looking down near this minus 24 degrees Celsius range. Now, lethal time, though, if you hold them at minus 5 for 3 days, you can get 100% mortality. Thank you. And then if you were to go down to minus 10 degrees Celsius, we can get control within 8 hours. We did a couple of freezing experiments where we actually put them into an ice cream freezer on a pallet. However, we did have someone decide to stack the bags into an ice cream tote, which has insulation about that thick on it. Couldn't figure out why they did that. What we had done was we had put temperature probes through this just to see when we could reach that sort of that 8 hours at minus 10. And what we found that if the bags are placed in an ice cream tote, then you're looking at 4 days. If you're looking at just a straight pallet, we can actually just freeze the pallets at minus 21 Celsius for 2 days and achieve particular control. So we're not dealing with a 10-day to 2-week type of aspect. They can get it in, they can get it frozen, and then they can get it back out on the shelves. Okay, so I'll just finish up there. Again, we do have substantial advantages with freezing. We do have the equipment. The disadvantages, again, the knowledge base needs to improve considerably before we can start making it really practical. Species, diet, and behavior are three things I think that are really important. Whether or not the product's going to be damaged, that's a common question asked of me. Well, I'm going to freeze this pet food. Am I going to damage it? Is there going to be mold? And that's a concern that needs to be addressed. And then finally, the delivery of freezing conditions. And I would like to thank my co-authors as well as the people that had and funds that had supported Mario's work. Thank you.